Spanish Day. I wanted to just take a few minutes to make a few remarks, obviously. There's a review that I've recently published, and I have some copies here. It's also a nice review by Boyd and Gauthier, which I wasn't aware of at the time I wrote this, in Progress in Optics this year. I guess there are a lot of reviews. There's a very nice review by Chow and Steinberg. And so, I'm here, so any questions that arise, I'd prefer if you know, unless they're really pressing questions, that we discuss during the week, and maybe I can just raise a few eyebrows or something and sort of motivate questions. So this will be very, very, very brief. We've already had some discussions for those of you who've arrived on signals versus information versus fronts, et cetera, et cetera. All right, just a couple remarks. One point is that this stuff is useful conceptually, and it leads to interesting conclusions and concepts. For example, we've all heard of the term spooky action at distance in connection with EPR correlations, but it is, of course, not possible to communicate the action at a distance superluminally with EPR correlations because having a correlated pair of photons, Alice and Bob, Alice cannot, although if Alice measures horizontal polarization, Bob will certainly measure vertical and likewise, you know the story here. But the point is that Alice cannot predetermine what she's going to measure, so she can't choose to send an H or a V to Bob, and so there's no way to really communicate by that scheme. You can, of course, also write things in terms of a different basis, horizontal, vertical, right, left, circular polarization. Alice can, of course, choose which polarization she chooses to measure, but still, that doesn't offer any means of communication because it is not possible to determine locally determine the polarization state of a single photon, or more generally, the eigenstate of a single particle locally. On the other hand, however, you can envision a situation where I might have a laser amplifier here, and I can amplify the photon that's headed toward Bob, and with a macroscopic number of photons, but you can conceive of situations where Bob can, with very high probability, determine which polarization state Alice chose to use, which would imply possibly a superluminal communication scheme. This was first suggested by Herbert about 20 years ago. And the conclusion is that one viewpoint is that since superluminal communication is impossible, if you start with that hypothesis, then one concludes that it must not be possible to amplify a single photon into putting a large number of photons into that exact same state, arbitrary state that you started out with. Another way to say, and this of course led to the no cloning theorem. Another way to say this is that the impossibility of superluminal communication implies that there is no perfect amplifier. And more classical-like arguments, which can also be made quantum mechanical, of course, suggest similarly that it is not possible to make a perfect filter if you insist that you cannot have superluminal communication. It's an old argument, and the clearest is perhaps due to Toll in the early 50s, but the basic idea is that if there's no input before, if you can't have any output before there's no input, and you imagine a so-called perfect filter that absorbs, takes away only one monochromatic frequency component, having taken away that component, a monochromatic wave is forever, so you will have an output before you have any input. So since we regard that as impossible, it must not be possible to have a perfect filter. And of course, the mathematical expression of this is that what has to happen is that the other frequency components must also be affected if you try to absorb just one frequency, and you have to introduce phase shifts so that the destructive interference you have here among all the frequency components persists here, and the condition for that is just that the you introduce phase shifts into all the other components so that you still have destructive interference, no output before input, and N of omega must be analytic in the upper half of the complex plane. That doesn't say anything about the speed of light. It just, it's the most primitive notion of causality, that there's no output before input. It's, if you assume a linear relation between the output and the input and time invariant type thing. When we start to talk about electromagnetic propagation, we can consider the simplest example of the simplest situation of plane wave propagation. And you can write down, just on physical considerations practically, you can write down what the input-output relation is. That is, you can write down the Green function. And using the condition that the refractive index is analytic in the upper half plane, this relation that you cannot have a electric displacement, that D is causally related to E, polarization is causally related to the inducing field. Such a relationship, and this gets into the kinds of discussions we've started to have last week, namely. It is often then concluded that by a simple application of Cauchy's theorem, you close your integral in the upper half plane, and if, because n of omega is analytic in that plane, and then you can show that if E at z at the input z equals zero is zero for times t less than zero, then you can show that via this application of Cauchy's theorem and this consequence for the Green function that the electric field must also vanish for all times t less than z after in a point z in the medium. So that's the simple notion that the front of a wave incident on a medium cannot propagate with a velocity greater than c. But implicit in that, as we discussed, was the assumption that the refractive index goes to 1 as the frequency goes to infinity. That's eminently reasonable physically. But there are situations that we discussed, for example, the Scharnhorst-Barton effect was the case we sort of discussed last week. In general, you cannot prove that rigorously that n of omega has to go to 1 for infinite frequency. So in general, we should really say that the front velocity is c divided by the real part of the index at infinite frequency. That's all you can really prove from this and that. If you believe that n of infinity is equal to 1, then of course you've got the old condition that signal velocity, the front velocity cannot exceed c. No. It's just that there are no poles in the upper half of the complex plane, so I can close my integral in that. So if you write down 1 over omega squared minus omega 0 squared, minus I beta, the usual kinds of things, the amplifier, what happens is that it's not the I beta that changes sign, it's the numerator that changes sign, population inversion. Yes, yeah. Although there are situations where, simple situations where you write down what the response is, for example, a radiative reaction classically, and you find that you do have poles in the upper half of the complex plane. And this is associated with precursors and runaways and that sort of thing. And one argues that precursors occur on such a short time scale that you really need to consider high energy quantum type effects there. So that's sort of another indication that quantum stuff is important to preclude superluminal communication. For a quasi-monochromatic field, plane wave field, we can write the field as follows, where this is presumably slowly varying on a scale of an optical period and an optical wavelength. And from this and the wave equation, it follows that you have such a partial differential equation for the envelope E. And if you can ignore this term, which I will call the group velocity approximation, where the group velocity is defined that way, we all know this, then the field can be, the solution of the field is just a distortionless propagation at the group velocity. We've heard a couple of talks mention already that of all the erroneous remarks that are made in classic textbooks, and the experiments of a number of you people here demonstrate that you can have distortionless or at least nearly distortionless propagation at the group velocity, with the group velocity being greater than c, without, as the textbooks say, the pulse becoming so distorted that the concept of group velocity breaks down. There are many insidious, subtle examples where the concept of group velocity is confused with that of signal velocity. One example, just to quote my sentimental favorite of all textbooks, is the Feynman Lectures on Physics, where he talks about the phase velocity of X-rays and glass being greater than c, but there's no problem, and we'll show in chapter 48 that the signal velocity is in fact less than c. And when he comes to that chapter, he calculates, based on a simple model, the group velocity, and finds that to be less than c, and says, therefore, there's no problem. The signal velocity is less than c. Of course, if he had considered a different situation of the type that people here have looked at, then he would have concluded that the group velocity is greater than c, and the signal velocity greater than c, and there would be an interesting paradox there. So one has to be careful about the... there's an important consequence of these formulas that I've written down here. And that is, I've written this formula, which actually follows from a nice paper by Diener, and I like the form of this. It says that the pulse propagating with group velocity v sub g is just the analytic continuation of the pulse that would propagate in vacuum. So I've got all these, the derivative appears in an exponential here. So if the function, if I have a group velocity greater than c, assuming n of infinity is 1, so the signal velocity, the front velocity is in fact c, there is really no superluminal transport of information because the output pulse moving superluminally, the peak moving superluminally, the bulk of the pulse moving superluminally, is just the analytic continuation of the input pulse. And so the argument or the putative inconsistency with causality, with Einstein causality, is reconciled by the fact that the information is already there. So we argue that it isn't that if you have a pulse which is not compact support in time, it extends like a hyperbolic secant or something, that the reconstructed pulse, the superluminal pulse, is just built up from the forward tail. And here is a picture of it. This is all linear, it's all, can all be classical. And yet, I think it's remarkable. So I'll just spend the last 2 minutes or so just going through this figure. What I'm showing is a situation where I have a Gaussian-like pulse propagating with a group velocity v sub g, which is greater than c. So because of causality, if you look at the green function relation we had, all of the points in this shaded area of the output pulse at time t are causally connected to all of the points at earlier times L over C. Okay, so in this case, all of this is just reconstructed from this little tail. And the larger I make the group velocity compared with C, the smaller and smaller is the tail that determines a larger and larger part of the output pulse. So in fact, in a limiting situation where VG is very, very large compared with C, I reconstruct practically the whole pulse from ever so small a tail of the input pulse. And this is remarkable. It's a consequence of what a strong conditioned analyticity is, but it tells us that no matter what the shape of the pulse is, as long as I have an analytic function, I can analytically continue and the output pulse is completely determined by this little tail here. So this is why we argue that there is no superluminal transport of information, because the information or the surprise is in fact already there in the weak tail, and this will be a point of contention. This little picture raises another interesting issue, which was first raised by Aharonov, and that is, suppose I consider a single photon wave packet or a few photon wave packet. In that case, the integral of this over time squared and so forth is just one photon, h bar omega of energy. But this photon here is determined by this little tail here. In the case when this corresponds to one photon, this can be just very, very small compared with one photon. So in essence, I'm determining the output pulse from mostly quantum noise. And so it should be difficult to observe this kind of an effect at the single photon level, because you'll be swamped by quantum noise. They gave sort of general arguments based on inverted pendula quantize and so forth, and we've looked at this for the case of the medium of two-level atoms, an amplifier, and showed that, in fact, it's the onset of superfluorescence that leads to a signal-to-noise ratio that's small in the case of a few photons. So I'll just write down the formula that the signal-to-noise ratio is proportional to the number of photons, Q, and the incident pulse, and then it goes as C times the pulse duration divided by group velocity minus C times L over C. What this tells us is that if the pulse advancement is large compared with the pulse duration, you'll be killed by noise. You won't be able to, you have a very small signal-to-noise ratio in the case when Q is on the order of 1. On the other hand, if you have a small advancement compared to the pulse duration, as in all of the optical experiments I'm familiar with, then there's no contradiction of this between this result and what has in fact been observed. So I think it would be very interesting to, among other interesting questions, to find a situation where you can make a photon gun such that the pulse advancement is large compared to the duration, and so you shoot your photon gun through this medium, and at some detector you will find, say, 99% of the time that you'll hear clicks that seem to have occurred as if the signal were the disturbance were propagating at a velocity, say, 10 times C. For all practical purposes, you would have superluminal type communication. But it isn't superluminal because all this is reconstructed from a little tail, and we have analyticity and so forth. So I'll be interested, among other things, to hear about results that apparently people have now achieved in which you can get advancements large compared with pulse durations, and whether you can, in fact, do such experiments at the single photon level. So, and I have copies of my review here if anyone is interested in that. So, let's just...